Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, it's me, Mike. I run the Sonar Podcast Network, the very one you're listening to right now. I love podcasting and I love the Canadian podcast community. And if you're a podcaster, work in podcasting, or just someone who loves podcasts, you're going to want to listen up. I'm proud to announce that I've been working very hard behind the scenes on an incredible podcasting event in Toronto on June 6th. The Soundwave Summit 2024. And as a Sonar listener, you get 15% off on all tickets with the code SONAR15. An awesome group of podcast companies and creators have banded together to create a space for podcasters and fans to build community, share knowledge, and celebrate indie productions. There will be a ton of informative sessions all day, including talks from Canada Land, Vocal Fry, Black Canadian Creators, Lead Podcasting, and of course, from us, the Sonar Network. In the evening, there will be a showcase of live podcast recordings from Blacklantic, Squirrel Talk, and the Women of Ill Repute. And it's all emceed by the amazingly talented and Survivor-winningest host of Happy to See Me podcast, Erica Kostupinen. Join us for insightful workshops on podcasting, networking with industry pros, drinks, and overall amazing opportunities to meet and collaborate with like-minded podcast lovers. Come for the sessions in the day, the live podcast showcase at night, or better yet, come for the whole thing. Tickets are going fast, so get them now at thesoundwavesummit.com. And don't forget to use the code SONAR15 for 15% off all tickets. That's SONAR15. See you there.
Hi, my name is Ian Geldart. I'm the producer of the Real Legitimate Anthology podcast. We're about to head into the second half of Real Legitimate Apparitions, and I thought it would be a good time to share with you a phone call I recently had with one of our longtime Patreon donors, Michael.
Hello?
Hi. Hi, is this Michael?
Yeah.
Huge thanks to you.
You're welcome, man.
I want to ask you just a couple of questions,
sure.
If that works for you. Yeah. So what, Michael, what's been your favorite moment or character or little storyline, favorite part of the last 2.5 seasons of RLA?
Oh, wow. There's a couple that come to mind. I think I really connect with season one. And the actor storyline growing up, I exclusively did acting. I was a performer and going to audition. Actor's life, I've lived it, and it brought back a bunch of memories.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, kind of a little bit relatable, that struggle. Well, beautiful. And so then what do you think that we can improve on over the, like, from what you've heard so far, like what are aspects that you think that we can work on to improve moving forward?
I think personally I would like a little bit more backstory to some people, just getting a little bit more info on them when we're first introduced.
And more info into like the main characters, kind of digging a little deeper.
Yeah, a little deeper dive.
And then last question, what made you decide to begin donating on Patreon? The point of this little segment that we're recording is to encourage people to do so. So what made you make that decision?
If you really like this podcast, why not give a little bit? A little goes a long way, and it shows them that people care, shows them that, you know, we the viewers matter, and I think we should give back to the creators to help them create further projects. I think that's important. Like this show keeps getting bigger, or the series I should say keeps getting bigger and bigger, and you know, to go further you need support, and we the listeners should support.
If you would like to support the show like Michael does, visit patreon.com/RLA series. We're able to produce these audio dramas at a low cost because we have professional, unionized actors who are willing to lend us their voices under a profit-share model. We don't need many donations to make a profit, and when we do, it's shared among our writers and talent. When you donate, you're supporting independent, grassroots storytelling and ensuring we're able to continue to produce high-quality audio dramas for free, two of which are being written right now. Again, to donate, visit patreon.com/RLA series. And don't worry, I will never call you out of the blue and ask you questions about RLA. And now, episode 6 of Real Legitimate Apparitions.
Real Legitimate Apparitions is told one episode after another, but exists all at once. Headphones recommended.
The following was recorded between November 26th, 2015, and January 3rd, 2016.
Hello, my name is Dylan McRae. If you've been listening to these recordings so far, you'll know that there's been a lot of developments in my life.
Dylan, there are people out there who know exactly what it is we can do, and they want to find us and stop us.
This whole recording my thoughts practice has kind of turned into what feels like a confessional.
And Neff crashed to the ground like a young tree.
But I have more things to admit, to share with you. More things to get off my chest. When I last recorded, I was arriving home and decided to look into my dad, because he seemed to be at the root of all this fucked up-ness. Fucked up at the root of this fucked up situation. The next morning, I woke up on the couch in my dirty clothes and covered in a thick layer of stale sweat. I went into the washroom, peeled the clothes off of my body, and stood outside of the shower, waiting for the water to heat up. I stared at myself in the mirror. "You're deep in it now," I said to the naked man looking back at me. "Why'd you do what you did?"
My body crawled to the other man and dropped the rock into his skull once, twice, three times.
The man said back, a little worried, "I didn't have a choice." I snorted at him in disgust. "Of course you had a choice. You met a random stranger who mentioned your dad, and then you went ahead and he cut me off. I wasn't in control." So I said, "Yes. But the second time you were, when you went back into that lighthouse after practicing hitting them with the rock, that was on purpose."
"I buried them as deep as I could."
"But they weren't even there," said the naked man. "They were. They must have been. Or they weren't, but that doesn't matter. You can't do something halfway once and claim you didn't do it and then do the other half and still claim that you didn't do it." I told him, not sure if what I had said even made sense. "Fine. I killed those two men," said the man in the mirror, changing from worried to defiant. "Shh, not so loud." I looked at the apartment walls and took an urgent step towards the mirror. "Everything is different now," said Dylan. "I'm not who I was before. The whole world isn't what it was before. The world hasn't changed," I told him. "Maybe it hasn't changed, but the way I see it has. Now I see it as it really is. Or I'm trying to." "That doesn't excuse what you did. What do you think would have happened if I had let them take me?" "I don't know." "Neff literally died to not have to go with them." "But you don't know for sure what would have happened." "I don't know anything for sure." "And neither do you. That's the truth. Don't shame me when you have no idea what's going on." The mirror was now clouded over with condensed steam, and the naked man looked like he stood behind a thick fog.
"Hi."
"I figured the one person who would be able to tell me the most about my dad was my mom. She lives in Ottawa, Ontario. You've heard her before in these recordings.
Hi, Mom. It's Dylan.
It had taken me a long session of deep breathing on the couch to, like, calm my mind enough to talk to someone.
Hi, how are you?
I mean, I definitely didn't want to talk to anyone. I wanted to curl up in a ball in my bed and die.
Fine. Yeah, all good on my end.
Oh, it's great to hear your voice.
Yeah, you too. How are you?
Good. Fine. Oh, Kate is over. We've been playing cards.
Really?
Mom still lives in the same house Rachel and I grew up in.
Yes, it's Dylan. Kate says hello.
Hello, Kate.
He says hello, Kate. You remember her, Dylan. She was over for the Thanksgiving dinner we had years ago.
I hadn't visited her or the house in about a year and a half. The house had always made me feel on edge. It was where I'd heard the music growing up that no one else could hear.
Yeah, I remember.
Where I had my first seizure.
Years ago.
Where Dad had left us.
Mom, I actually wanted to ask you something.
Sure.
About Dad, actually.
Your dad?
Yeah.
Well, there's not much to say.
But you know more than I do.
Why do you want to know about him?
I don't know. He left money, I guess.
But he left you that money because you're his child. Why he wanted you to wait until you were in your 30s to get his money, I'll never know.
But he didn't know me.
Well, he didn't know anyone. I'll tell you one thing. He didn't leave us to join another family. The state he was in, no one else would have had him.
What do you mean?
He was a distracted man. He never listened. He didn't care about anything that had to do with anything. He wouldn't have even noticed another woman. I understand that you want to know more about him, but there's not much to know, Dylan. You have the money, and that's worth more than he could have ever meant to you if you had known him.
It always bugged me that people told me I never knew my dad, because in my mind, growing up, I had. He left when I was 7. I remembered him. I remembered his smell. Him sitting on the back porch.
How did you two meet?
By accident. My friends and I had gone camping in the Algonquin Park, and he was tented at the lot beside us. He needed a lighter. We invited him over. He went on hikes with us. Kayaked with us, just joined in on the trip. He said that he had had a vision that he would meet his wife on that trip.
A vision?
I don't know. He was a spiritual man.
Did he have a lot of those?
Visions? I don't know. I don't know why.
I don't know.
No, he didn't.
Why did he leave?
Well, that's an excellent question, Dylan. I can't talk for too long because Kate and I are going for coffee.
That's fine. What did he tell you when he left us?
Nothing that made much sense. He went on about time and pressure. He had a lot of things to do. He said he realized something, whatever that means.
Like he had a religious experience.
Exactly. Yes.
Did he tell you what it was about?
Oh, no.
Or what he, like, realized?
No. He just said he was running out of time, like a midlife crisis.
When was the last time you saw him?
I have to say, you remind me a lot of him, Dylan. The older you get, the more I see him in you. It does make me uncomfortable telling you about him because I don't want you to turn into him. I love you, and I'm sorry that he left you with questions.
Yeah, it's not your fault. I just want to know more.
I know. I should go, though.
The Dylan who ran Haunt Force, who went on about 2-night visits being 3-day visits, who argued with Thomas about the title of head leader, that Dylan didn't exist anymore. That Dylan never made it out of the lighthouse. That Dylan would have let my mom go, let her avoid the question, let her go off with Kate for coffee, which she for sure didn't have to do right now. But this Dylan, my Dylan, me Dylan, I wasn't gonna let that happen.
Mom.
The Dylan who didn't want to seem obsessive or weird or a freak had been fighting against who he really was. Who I am.
Don't avoid this.
I'd been afraid that the people that I cared about would leave if I acted as if I was in an obsessive state. But the fact is that I was. I am.
I'm not.
If I told my mom that I had killed 2 people and buried 4 outside of a lighthouse on Toronto Island, she would definitely leave me or judge me or whatever. Compared to that, being obsessive was nothing.
Then tell me, when was the last time you saw Dad?
I didn't tell you.
Didn't tell me what?
I didn't tell you because it didn't matter, and I didn't want you to worry.
What didn't you tell me?
It doesn't matter. But I'll tell you if you want to know. He came here the day he died. You and Rachel were at school. I hadn't seen him in years and years. He just showed up at the front door, asked if he could come in. He looked so different, so much older than I remembered him. He came in and I made him a tea. He didn't tell me where he'd been or what he'd done over the years. He wanted to ask about me, what I'd done. I told him I raised his kids. My friends have told me that the older men get, the more their little eccentricities become pronounced. All the little oddities you could have ignored when they were middle-aged really start to take over them. Of course, I had never known that, but I saw it in your dad. He asked to look around a bit at all the rooms. Walked up and down the hallway, peering around corners, remembering moments from when we were all together. He seemed in another world. We sat on the couch and he asked if there were any photo albums. I went down to the basement to get some, and when I came back, I heard he had been muttering to himself and clapping and flicking the lights on and off. It was sad. We looked through the albums and he left. I wasn't mad at him. I didn't hate him like I thought I would if I ever saw him again. He was so different. Like an old man who used to be my husband, your dad. Almost like meeting a stranger. Apparently he died that evening. I'm sorry I didn't tell you. I genuinely thought it didn't matter.
Where was his house?
He lived over near Bancroft, about 3 hours west. He left his house to me.
Yeah. Do you remember the address?
Oh, I don't. I never even went there. Just sold it off as quick as I could. But it would be in that will.
Yeah, yeah.
Living with your dad was like living with someone who was always only half present, half listening, half smiling, half sleeping. It was as if I almost had a husband. Like he was just out of reach all the time. By the time he told me he was leaving, I told him he was already gone.
I'm sorry, Mom. That sucks.
And I've always been afraid that you would live a half life like he did.
I'm gonna try not to.
You are not alone. I struggled for many years with what was happening to me. You might say I'm still struggling. When something happens to you that you don't understand, you don't know how to explain it, that fundamentally separates you from most other people. A kind of withdrawal happens. You recede away from others because it's exhausting to have to constantly try and forget and avoid these experiences. You feel trapped, as if you're in a prison. It's as if telling anyone who will listen what you're going through is a fundamental need, and at the same time, a paralyzing fear. Fear is a good way to describe the early half of my life. I feared my movements. I was relieved when I had a seizure without one. I thought I was seeing ghosts or demons or that I was simply losing my mind. Nobody wants to talk about seizures, let alone seizures in which you experience inexplicable things. That's why I want to say again, you are not alone. You are not crazy or insane or deluded. You are not seeing ghosts or demons or anything nefarious. You are every bit as worthy and real and deserving as anyone else. In fact, by a happy accident, you have a skill. When you gain control of your movements, you will begin to see the world in a different way than others. But this doesn't mean you yourself are any more special or less special than anybody else. I wished for many years that I didn't have epilepsy, that I didn't have seizures, but even more, I wished I could live a life free of movements, that I could cut them out of me, that I could be like everybody else. But I'm not. And neither are you. But that doesn't mean you're alone.
Dad left in 1990 when I was 6. I don't remember much of an explanation at the time from him or from anyone. But I also don't remember much fighting. I never, like, came into the kitchen to my parents yelling at each other like a lot of kids of divorce did. There was a bit of time with the counselor that was torture. Someone gave me a coloring book of kids with only one parent and a book about a little boy with only a mom. It seemed like a huge deal for the first couple years of elementary school, but when I figured out that tons of other kids didn't have dads, it became less of a deal. Dad's will was in a box in the closet of my apartment. Mum had been right. I had remembered seeing his address in it.
Okay, this is the box. I keep all my different paperwork in here. And here is the folder the lawyer gave me. The Last Will and Testament of Nathan Portune. I only ever read this once and it was at the bank. This is the last will of me, Nathan Portune, of 179 Reed Road, Bancroft, Ontario, born March 18th, 1955. There's some legalese, and then the release of the deed of my house on 179 Reed Road shall happen upon my death. The release of all monies and possessions shall happen at a time deemed necessary by my power of attorney. See page 6. Okay. Page 6. Power of attorney. I appoint Nephilim Armoni as my power of attorney. To my son Dylan Nathan McCrae Portune and my daughter Rachel Diana McCrae Portune, I split all financial assets to do with as they see fit and to help them in their lifelong journey of self-discovery. To my ex-wife, Catherine McCrae, I leave my house and its associated land to do with as she likes. Then further down are some poems he wrote to each of us, which none of us had been interested in when he died. I don't even think Rachel ever read her poem. For Catherine, to fall in love with a caterpillar would be wonderful until the caterpillar realizes that it is not all he's meant to be. For when a caterpillar dreams of flying, it is time for him to go. When a caterpillar misleads himself, he misleads everyone he knows. So I fly now after the long cocoon, and I am sorry, love. I didn't know I was a caterpillar at all. Okay, he's obviously not a very good poet. I don't know why he chose to start now. For Rachel, you burn so bright for something so small. When I hold you, I hold the sun. I cannot see you, for you blind me so. I did not know you, for it was my time to go. You are forever a question mark to me. I hope so dearly that you will be free. Yeah, that's what he wrote to her. So, for Dylan. A path is set for the pioneer. In the jaws of oblivion, this path takes him. On one hand, damnation, you fall to the floor. On one hand, absolution, like never before. There is only ever one future path of the pioneer, as in my life, all lives, only one. You must shed what you know of the world, and only then you will find the secret truth you might see through a crack in your mind. Because you saw me in the lighthouse, like truth hidden in a lockbox, I will see you again and we will be free.
I froze. My spine tingled. I had read this poem before when the lawyer had given me the will over a year ago, but now it had a different meaning. Because you saw me in the lighthouse. I'd thought that line was just some metaphor, but now it seemed pretty real. This poem also reminded me of something else I had read. Something else that my dad had written to me, the note I had taken from under the floorboard at the lighthouse. I was pretty sure both mentioned lockboxes. I took the note out of my wallet, where I had kept it tightly folded. It read,
Dylan, if you have come this far in the journey, then you have been through some confusing experiences. I am sorry. Space is a floor on which we all walk. The way we experience our lives is mysterious and is of great concern. I spent my life trying to discover, but once you shed your previous conceptions and establish a system to follow, you will find at least some clarity. I hope you find a clarity in an easier way, in a less painful way than I did. Clarity is in a lockbox. Let me help you find the key.
The letter went on again, but this was the first paragraph. The end of the poem was kind of similar.
Because you saw me in the lighthouse, like truth hidden in a lockbox, I'll see you again, we will be free. Both went on about a lockbox, and both kind of sounded similar. But what did he mean by a lockbox? Was he trying to tell me something? The last word of each of them, key and free, rhymed. Was that something? In fact, the last lines were super similar. Let me help you find the key. I'll see you again, we will be free.
And actually...
1, 2, 3,
they had
four,
the
five.
Same number of words. 8. And before that line, in each of them, was the word lockbox. I looked for other similarities in each piece of writing. One was poetry, the other was prose. But they each had the same gist, about finding a truth, and about how crappy life is. They each talked about floors. The will said,
on one hand, damnation, you fall to the floor.
And the note?
Space is a floor on which we walk.
They were also at similar points in the paragraphs, about a quarter of the way in. In fact,
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11,
they were the same number of letters in. 25. I looked at the first sentence of each one. The poetry?
A path is set for the pioneer in the jaws of oblivion. This path takes him.
And the prose?
Dylan, if you have come this far in the journey, then you have been through some confusing experiences.
Not many similarities there, just the jaws of oblivion and confusing experiences. I knew which one I liked more. Looking again at the texts, I noticed that they both talked about shedding away what you had thought before. The will?
You must shed what you know of the world, and only then you will find the great secret truth you might see through a crack in your mind.
And the note?
But once you shed your previous conceptions and establish a system to follow, you will find at least some clarity.
Why would Dad have given me 2 notes that said pretty much the same thing? Both of these excerpts started about halfway through the texts. In fact, the word shed was
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10,
the 53rd word 15, in each. I looked for other similar words. None of them stood out. So I set to work, counting words.
1, Dylan, 2, if path, 3, you, is, 4, have set, 5, come, 4, 6, this, the, 7, far, pioneer, 8, in, there we go.
The same words, in. I circled each in and continued.
9, the.
Again, the same words. I circled them, and I continued until I came back to the word floor.
25, floor.
And then word 40.
Of.
And then word 45.
My.
Then 53.
Shed.
63.
You.
64.
Will.
65.
Find.
74. And 91.
Lockbox.
Lesson 7. Completing the circle. During a movement, our consciousness glimpses another moment, or rather a duration of our timeline. By visiting the future, we create a memory of the future. The question is, with such a memory, do we have to create these pre-known events? Imagine you're in your home and have a movement to a future in which you're reading a recipe for cookies in a cookbook. After recovering from the movement, you realize that you don't own this cookbook, but you do remember the cookie recipe. You like the look of the recipe, and so you go to your kitchen and make these cookies. The question that will arise is whether or not you now have to go and bring home this cookbook in which you found the recipe to make possible the movement you had in the past. The uncomfortable answer is that it doesn't matter. You will, by the laws of the universe, at some time in the future, read that cookbook in your home. The choice is not up to you. Or rather, your will is not up to you. The reality is that at one point you will read that recipe book in your home in the future. If you were to just sit on your hands and refuse to go to get the cookbook, you are only creating a greater problem for yourself down the line. You are delaying the inevitable. This is important, okay? I think it's the tendency of a lot of people to figure, well, I know I'm going to read the cookbook in my home, so I don't have to try to make it happen. Fine. But say you wait until you're old and sick. You still have to complete that circle one way or another. Or say, as is the case with a lot of us, you have multiple movements and you allow them to build up and build up until you realize that it's actually going to take a substantial amount of time to complete all these circles. That's what happened to me. I realized that the life that I had created was dependent on me doing all of these things that I had seen myself do. See, we're used to working now for a reward in the future. what a circle sometimes creates is a reward that pre-exists the work that must be put in. Let me give you, I guess, a personal example.
179 Reed Road, Bancroft, Ontario, is in the middle of nowhere. If you leave Toronto and take the Don Valley Parkway north past the big 401 highway and past the 404 and continue north for just over 50K, or about 35 miles, or about 45 minutes without traffic, you get to Lake Simcoe. Lake Simcoe itself is 460 square miles, so it's a trek to get around. Luckily, you don't have to do that. You head east. You navigate your way through the enormous grid of single-lane highways that create straight lines across the map of Ontario. Get on Highway 48, continue for 20 miles, turn north on Highway 12, continue for 8 miles, turn east on Highway 48 again, continue for 25 miles, north on 35, continue for 5 miles, east on 45, continue for 10 miles, then 503, 22 miles, 118, 14 miles, 28, 6 miles. Finally, after 160 miles and 3.5 hours of driving, you get to Reed Road.
Hello?
When you turn off of Highway 28 and onto Reed Road, it takes you down to the shores of Whitefoot Lake, a small lake about 1,500 feet long. The January day that I was there, it was icy, with gravel tossed here and there to give car tires some traction.
Hi, my name is Dylan McRae. Is this Sarah Henderson of 179 Reed Road?
The road meanders along its northern shore and then deep into the frozen woods of eastern Ontario.
It is.
Hi. I understand that you bought your house from my mother, Catherine McRae?
Yes, Catherine, that name rings a bell. I don't think I ever met the previous owners, though.
No, you wouldn't have.
The house is small, simple, and far away from any other lots. Tall, evergreen trees encircle the house, leaving room for only a small little lawn and rock garden hidden under the snow. Some people might say it looked like an isolated hovel for a hermit. Others might say it's a private, secret oasis. Behind the house must be the shed.
Hello.
Hi. I'm Dylan.
Hi, Dylan. Nice to finally meet you.
There was a time when I would have grabbed this woman's hand, shaken it vigorously while staring into her eyes, and say, "My name's Dylan McRae, chief leader of Haunt Force." I restrained the urge.
Come on in.
Sarah Henderson leads me into her small home. A calming living room with wicker furniture is on my right. A small, neat kitchen with a yellow stovetop kettle on the counter is on my left. A hall leads to what is probably the bathroom and her bedroom. Tiny, but like, homey, and yeah, calming. I sit on the wicker love seat and tell her about my family. Not like everything, obviously, but the normal stuff. Divorce, death, curiosity.
Is it true that there's a shed?
There is. The real estate agent offered to have it taken down because it was in a state when I saw the place.
What kind of state?
They tried to clean it out. I think your dad must have used it as a kind of art studio.
She's trying to be polite, I think. She wants to say it had been a total mess and looked like a lunatic had been living in it, but she doesn't.
Do you mind if I see it?
The backyard is small. Sarah has some planters along the side of her house that are filled now with snow and ice. The trees close in, and from behind the house, the feeling of isolation is a lot more intense. As if this backyard could exist independently from the rest of the universe. A path of footprints from before the last snowfall lead to the stout shed with two barn-style doors. Sarah nods me on. I open the shed doors.
I met my wife, the mother of my kids, while I was in a movement. It was a time in my life when I was having movements all the time. I was experimenting, or it could have been a kind of self-harm. My actions during these movements created the life I ended up living. It was because I was doing what I did in another time that I met my wife. I waited too long, until I realized that to make my life possible, I'd have to leave and do the work to get a reward that I'd already had.
The doors swing open without a creak. Inside, The walls are painted a delicate yellow. There's a small manual lawnmower, a large snow shovel, a few bags of gardening earth, and a cabinet of small drawers, each with the Latin name of a plant written on it.
I like to garden.
I turned to Sarah. She might have been the most peaceful person I'd ever met. She lives here alone, with her plants and her wicker furniture, and seems so happy. Like she doesn't need anything else, like a monk. I look at her and wonder what a life like that might be like.
Have you ever looked under the floor?
She hadn't. Together, we move out the shovel, bags of earth, the other gardening tools, and roll out the little mower until a large patch of bare floorboards show. They're nailed in place.
Do you have a hammer?
Sarah watches as I use the claw part of a hammer to lever the nails out of her floor. Once the first floorboard's free, I lift it out. There's definitely a space underneath. With no windows on the shed, there isn't much light to work with. The space beneath the floor is just a gaping black chasm. Human instinct tells us pretty clearly to never stick your hand blindly into a gaping black chasm. Which makes me think of how many past humans and human-type creatures must have lost their hands by doing this, so that my body, at this moment, was screaming at me not to stick my hand blindly into this gaping black chasm. But I do.
I'd like to level with you here for a second. I might seem like I know what I'm talking about, but I don't. I have my research to go off of. I have my experiences. I have my hypotheses, but I don't really have any knowledge. That's because for most of my life, I've been alone. It's impossible for a doctor to accurately map what's happening inside a brain during a seizure, because all they see is a mess of electricity. Doctors say that it makes sense that you might see things or hear things or lose control during a seizure, because all of those parts of your brain are going haywire. We don't understand how the brain works at all, and so we don't understand movements. Together, we can build a community. We can share our experiences. We can learn from each other. Like any research study, we can't get generally applicable knowledge from one subject, let alone from studying oneself. Together, we can form a greater understanding of what is happening to us and perhaps capitalize on our ability and at least find solace in each other's shared experiences. That's part of why I'm putting together these lessons. To help you. And also invite you to be a part of my life. To share our time.
There is cold cement about 10 inches below the floor. And nothing else. I continue to pry out nails and free a few more floorboards. Now the opening's about a foot wide and a couple of feet long, and I can see the damp cement base clearly. This time, I take out my phone and turn on the flashlight. I stick my phone into the opening, shine the light across the dark space, and crane my neck to try to see anything. And I see something a few feet away under the floorboards and under Sarah's heavy chest of plant drawers. So I slip my phone freehand into the space, up to my shoulder, and reach. My fingertips touch what feels like plasticky wrapping paper. I shove my arm in further until I can grab a corner of the wrapping and I pull. It's heavy, and the cement it drags across isn't smooth. Finally, Sarah watches as I withdraw the object from the floor of her shed. It's rectangular and wrapped in a garbage bag that's been taped shut to keep the water out. I don't want to open it in front of her, so I nail her floorboards back in. We replace the mower and bags of dirt. I tell her thank you for her time and patience and for letting me dismantle her shed. She says she was happy to help. I go back into the car, sit in the driver's seat, and place the garbage bag wrapped object on the passenger seat. Before I turn the key, I take a moment to look at the house, and I think how simple it would be to just leave the world, find a little house and garden. Or not a garden, I wouldn't want a garden. I don't know, draw or write or something. Why couldn't I do that? Why couldn't I just throw my hands up and say, screw it, I'ma be a hermit? After all, isn't doing all this so I can find some kind of peace and understanding and relax in a safe space? Aren't we all just trying to do that? Like, it's as if we're all running around and wishing and dreaming for a moment when we can just stop. as if by running around will ever lead to us stopping, when what leads to us stopping is stopping. But obviously I hadn't grasped that concept, because I turned the key and drove away.
A beacon is a term for an event in time that draws those who experience it towards it. During a movement, our consciousness tends to attach to durations of time which were stimulating, memorable. If you and I were in a conversation, and I told you something that I wanted you to remember, and perhaps to revisit through a movement, I might jump into the air, or clap my hands, or grab your shoulders with my hands and shake you. Doing this will create a stronger memory and will increase the chances of a future movement landing there.
Reed Road led me back to Whitefoot Lake, where I slowed. I figured not many people drove up and down this little gravel trail, so I put the car in park and turned off the engine. Like I said, the lake was small and covered in ice. I could see at the south end a collection of houses, a few with docks and canoes. I picked up the wrapped rectangular box. Like I said, it was heavy. I stretched and tore the black garbage bag. When all the plastic was torn away and tossed to the passenger's seat, on my lap was an old brown metal box. It looked like maybe it was a lunchbox from like the 50s, except unlike a lunchbox, it had a combination lock on it. I rotated the four metal wheels with the numbers 1 to 9 etched into them. They turned smoothly. First, I turned them to 1, 2, 3, 4, which didn't work. And then my birthday, which also didn't work. I looked down at the box and wondered how I would feel if, after all I'd been through, I was defeated by four little numbers on a lockbox. I opened the glove box where I was keeping all the papers I had acquired so far. There was the City of Toronto flyer with Neff's message, my dad's will, and two notes, one that I had found under the floorboard of the lighthouse, and one that Neff had given me. I compared Dad's poem from the will and his note under the floorboard again. 11 words were circled, the words that had led me to find this box. I entered the number that corresponded to their place in the texts. The first common word, in, was the 8th word in the text. The second, the, was the 9th. The third, floor, was the 25th. I rotated the dials to show 8, 9, 2, 5. Which didn't work. I tried all the combinations I could think of that came out of the message that had sent me to the shed. Nothing. But then I took out the note that Neff had given me in the lighthouse. The note they had written themselves describing what I'd been thinking. It said, he was thinking about light bouncing off the moon and into the lighthouse and off of this note and into my eyes. Important numbers he will think of. 5, 8, 2, 3. In that order. These are the numbers that opened the box. The lid opened smoothly, as if the hinges had been freshly oiled. Inside was a cluster of notes scrawled on little pieces of paper and a scattering of memory cards, SD cards, each in little plastic holders. On each plastic holder were cramped words written in felt-tip marker. There was also a voice recorder, a simple black device with a couple of buttons and a display screen that was blank. On top of all this, one note was laid bare. It was written with a fine-tipped black pen and in a kind of frenetic, disorganized scrawl. And it was addressed to me. Dylan, if you're reading this, everything is going to plan. I have done it. I am ending my life now, here in the shed. This is where I end my journey, but this is where you begin yours. See you soon, Dad. I picked up the voice recorder and pressed play.
I'm not a scientist or a philosopher, but I have had experiences which I've spent the better part of my life attempting to understand. The research and experimentations I've conducted have led me to certain conclusions and opened the door to a variety of possibilities. The following lessons are an attempt to describe these conclusions and possibilities in hopes that you might...
As I listened, I picked up another note written on a larger piece of paper, about 4 inches across. Camping trip, it said. Algonquin Park, Brent Campground, Lot 29, behind Giant Tree. Catherine stands on the southwest side of the lot with her friends. She crosses left to the table beside the campfire. Say, "Hi, sorry to bug you, but could I borrow a lighter just to light my fire?" Pause. Say, "Oh yeah, no problem. I'm just at the lot next door." The note continued until return to Lot 29. Sit on the north corner behind the tent to begin seizure. Then, in different pen, was written the words, "Completed. Can't believe C liked me." I jolted as the phone buzzed in my pocket. Instinctively, I shut the metal box and laid on the seat beside me. I awkwardly lifted my butt off the seat and jammed my hand in my pocket. The phone said I was getting a call from Rachel. My heart jumped again in my chest, but this time with joy. I wanted to tell someone about everything, and the one person with the best chance of understanding was Rachel. I answered.
Hey.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, man. Wild stuff is happening.
Really? What?
And then I froze. If I told her about this box, I'd have to tell her about the notes. If I told her about the notes, I'd have to tell her about Neff. If I told her about Neff, I'd have to tell her about what happened at the lighthouse.
Hello?
But if I couldn't tell Rachel, I couldn't tell anyone.
Dylan?
And I'd have to do it all on my own.
Hello?
Without Rachel ever knowing a thing.
I can't hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sorry. Hi.
What's wild?
Oh, nothing. Like life, you know?
Yeah, life. That's the most wild thing of all. Have you done any more Haunt Force sessions?
No, none. No, I guess actually I did.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I went to this old guy's house to look up some click noises.
How was it?
Pretty good.
Were you okay?
Yeah, I was all good. There was nothing there. Remember you called me saying that someone called you about me?
Yeah.
What did they say again?
I don't know, it was nothing. They weren't with you, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah?
Anyway, I'm coming back to Toronto. Says his dad is in the States, so we're gonna go hang out at his place for the weekend. I don't know if I'll see you, though.
Yeah.
It's like a couple's getaway.
A couple's?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I thought I'd tell you because I knew you'd be pissed if I didn't tell you and that you wouldn't care if I did tell you, so I thought I'd better tell you.
Hey, I care.
Mom said you were asking about Dad.
She told you about that?
Yeah, she was a bit worried. She told you about when he turned up?
On the day he died?
I looked at the metal box again and thought about the note. I have done it. I'm ending my life now.
Yeah.
She told you too?
Well, obviously I knew. Mom told me what had happened. She told me not to tell you.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it was weird. Let's not keep secrets from each other. Mom kept saying it was for the best because you might take it the wrong way.
It came out of nowhere.
How do you know what I might have done?
I know.
How does Mom know what I might have done?
I get it.
No, you don't. None of you know what I might do.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, I could have just not told you that I knew.
Well, fuck, fine. Don't tell me whatever you want.
Well, maybe I can't because you react like you're a demented loser.
But you're thinking again about what I might do. Maybe it's because you and Mom are always thinking about how I might act that I have fucked up reactions. Why don't you two just treat me like a normal person, and then maybe I can have some normal fucking person reactions.
Like right now?
Like, fuck! You and Mom are always complaining about how much of a freak Dad was after he shows up at her house. You were probably laughing about it the same night he was dying.
Oh, please.
You don't know what he was thinking or why he was there,
don't
okay?
Don't fucking defend that guy to me. He abandoned you when you were a kid. He abandoned me as soon as I was born. The difference between you and me is I'm okay. I don't give a shit. I don't have a dad. I never did, but you think you do. It's pathetic. So don't fucking come after me for keeping something from you when you have some serious issues about
your
dad.
You had any idea what you were talking about?
Oh, I know fucking exactly what I'm talking about. You don't know him anything, Dylan. He was a freak, and until you get that, we can't talk about him.
Great. I would never, ever talk to you about him.
And yet I'm the only person you can talk to.
I looked at the metal box again.
I think you know everything, but you don't know shit.
Yeah, okay. See you never.
I clenched the phone and squeezed it as hard as I could. If it broke, it broke. And if it broke, it was all Rachel's fault. But I couldn't crush it. I couldn't do anything. I whipped the phone on the seat beside me and bashed my head into the steering wheel of the car. I screwed up my face and screamed silently. Then I realized that I was in a car in the dead of winter in the middle of nowhere. So I screamed out loud. I drove the long trek back to Toronto in the dark and in silence. Snow was blasting in front of my headlights. Cars were rolling slowly along the highway in the right lane with their hazards on, so afraid that they might slip or slide and end up in the ditch. But I wasn't afraid. I flew past them like one massive careening snowflake. I knew I'd be okay because there was still so much I had to do. When I arrived home, I was still on edge. I swung open my apartment door and turned on the lights. The place was a mess. I dropped my papers onto the living room table. I was still wearing my shoes and I tracked snow all over the hall. When I went back to the door to take my boots off, I saw an envelope lay on the floor. It must have been slipped under the door while I was away. It had my name on it. I tore it open and found a typed letter. A letter from Thomas Bracknell. You can follow this story on Instagram and Twitter with @RLAseries. Please consider visiting patreon.com/RLAseries to support the show and reviewing it on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for listening.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Sonar Network.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.